Hey, morning, everybody. Welcome back to the M1 Hangout. Today we have, let me just go back. Let's say if you could have a favorite cyclist, a favorite American cyclist, the guy who sort of represents the full spectrum of capacities. He's a ski racer. He's a mountain biker. He's a badass on the road, and consistently put out and was great for as long as he decided to be great. It is our great pleasure to have Levi, the Levi Leipheimer, chatting to us. He's a local kid. He lives near us. We've known each other for a few years, and I'm so stoked to have him kind of talk about his experiences racing, and even his experiences sort of racing as a master athlete. Levi, welcome. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Good morning.
Morning.
Well,
I'll tell you what,
how's the construction?
You know, we're living the construction dream. In the background here, you can see the guys. We're getting a new fence in, and forgive us on the noise, but we're getting closer to living in the dream. You know, the idea is for me to become agoraphobic, so I never have to leave the house. Well,
I'm the same way. Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. So, you know, there's so much to talk about here, but you know, you are. I'd love to start with this idea of what did, when you kind of quit racing, you haven't stopped racing, but when you've quit racing at the highest level to now, has that been a tricky transition internally around sort of, you know, giving up the mantle of as the ultimate professional athlete? Because you were professional for decades, and I know a lot of people who struggle when they quit the Olympics or they stop the national team or they stop competing at a high level. There's sort of this ends up being this vacuum in their life. Did you have any of that letdown?
Oh yeah, and it's becoming more and more apparent. You know, to this point, that's something that is extremely hard to replace. I don't think I'll ever be able to replace that exactly, obviously. But it's difficult to find something else that is so consuming and something that you're so passionate about and that you're so good at, and you know, the stars sort of aligned for myself and I think for a lot of athletes who, you know, dedicated their whole lives and made it to that highest level in their sport or whatever it was they were doing. So it's you know, it's obviously always a short career when you're an athlete because your body doesn't go forever. And yeah, it's a really difficult transition. That's sure. There's no doubt.
You have a pretty amazing fundraiser ride. Can you talk about that? I mean, because I know being the organizer in the face of that, it does occupy a big chunk of time. I mean, you were doing that when you're racing. But can you talk about sort of that piece and sort of the way you're giving back through cycling still?
Yeah, so in 2009, I had this idea. Well, in Italy, they have these rides called Gran Fondos, which are sort of, they kind of straddle the line between a group ride and a race. And it's for anybody to enter, and there's three different distances. There's 30 miles, there's 65 miles, and there's 103 miles. Actually, next year we added a new route that's 118 miles with like 11,000 feet of climbing, but it's just for a few people. But you know, it's epic and people love that, so it sold out right away. But anyway, in Italy they've traditionally had these for a long time, these Gran Fondos. And 2009, I had the idea that it's time for Sonoma County and Northern California and the United States to have some Gran Fondos. So we started Gran Fondo together with Bike Monkey in the city of Santa Rosa, and the community's been great. I mean, so many people put so much work into it. We have over 1,000 volunteers every year, and it's just it's an army. And you know, the first year before the first event, I thought, well, maybe we'll get a few hundred people, and we actually that first year had 3,500. Second year, we went to 6,000. And the third year was like 7,500, and we've been around that 7,000 mark since. And over the first 6 years of the event, we've raised about $1.5 million for local charities, and mainly our main beneficiary is the Forget Me Not Farm, which is a therapy farm for at-risk kids. They get to go to the farm, work with these rescued farm animals, and it helps teach them compassion and love and help break that cycle of abuse that they've had in their lives. And that's important to my wife and I. Odessa, she's been a volunteer there for like 8 years. She's only missed one day of volunteering in those eight years. So she's really dedicated to it. She's very passionate about it, and it means a lot for us to be able to, you know, to give so much back. For me, especially, because throughout my whole life, I've had, you know, countless people help me get to that point in my cycling career at the top, and you know, now that I'm not doing that, you know, like I said, that transition's hard. But having the Gran Fondo and helping these kids and being able to also, we sponsor the NorCal League, which is, you know, high school mountain biking it's a high school sport now, and it started in Northern California. And our Gran Fondo is the main sponsor of the NorCal League now. So I get to ride with a lot of these kids that are in the league and kind of, you know, motivate them and tell them what I know about cycling, and that's a lot of fun. So that has been my savior over the last few years since I retired.
Well, one of the things that we're always talking about with our athletes is saying, hey, look, you have this unique skill set. How can you retool that skill set to volunteer, to change? And, you know, you've just – one of the reasons I want you to talk about it, because we have so many athletes who are listening who have had significant athletic careers that really changed their lives and opened a million doors for them. And then figuring out how do you work that back into your community. And you guys, you know, you're such an icon around. I mean, if you live up in the Santa Rosa area, I mean, you'll see Levi out on the roads and riding. I mean, you're just been a fixture there, and it's so great how you've been able to really tie all these aspects into the passion, to the, you know, and end up still being such a kind of a contributing kind of force. I mean, the Gran Fondo is really, really well known, you guys, and I think it really is the model for what we're trying to get our athletes to say, hey, look, you don't just shut the door and go on, is that there is this other play. It's so killer.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this.
It'll never be exactly the same, but there's definitely a way to parlay your talents into something, you know, bigger than yourself and to help other people.
You know, one little known fact about Levi and Odessa, you guys, is that they also rescue dogs. Like, if you don't think that you're, you know, already doing enough, you know, some additional work, if you go to their house, how many rescue dogs do you guys have right now? You're babysitting?
House-sitting? 10.
Only 10 dogs. When I was there, I think you only had 14 or 15 chihuahuas, I think, at the time.
Yeah, right.
And if you lay on the ground, it's like a waterfall of chihuahuas on you, and it's literally like a peak experience for me.
That still happens. Luckily, they're being very quiet right now.
We went out and we got Jupiter, who is our Chihuahua rescue. You know, it's a Chihuahua Jack Russell, after hanging out at Levi's house. So there's a little little background fact. People don't know how we got Jupiter, but it's after we were inspired by the Leipheimer family.
Very cool.
Let me ask you this: a lot of people finish their sport and they never do their sport again. They never, ever want to touch it. They don't want to see it. It wasn't any fun. Did you have the similar experience?
No, and that's been really hard for me to understand, because for me, the love of riding my bike was the foundation of my career and why I was able to, I think, get the most out of myself. I always thought of myself as the guy who really, you know, got every last fraction of percentage out of myself, out of my talent that I was born with, because I love to ride my bike, and I still ride my bike a ton. And, you know, I'm pretty much as fit as I ever was. I mean, I don't have that racing specific power or fitness that I had, but I'm just as efficient as I ever was.
That's pretty impressive. I mean, you pulled up on your mountain bike. You'd just done a little tour in our neighborhood. So, you know, I think what that leads into is you still have this love of cycling. Still are, I mean, clearly, I mean, you know, pretty well in your age category. You did some things that I think are really impressive, being able to sort of flip sports. So, like, for example, you are the Leadville, one of the Leadville 100 champions, which is pretty amazing that you could go from, because I hear a lot of mountain bikers sort of denigrate the road cyclists. You know, they're like, that's not, this is mountain biking, this is a sport. But you flip-flopped back and forth between the two and just jumped on the mountain bike and cruised. Was that tricky? Was that weird? Because, I mean, I'm setting you up for the next question. So, I mean, we talk about that because it's pretty amazing that you were able to flip-flop so fast.
Well, that was, you know, my love of the bike was, it became a bit of a handicap at some points, because sometimes, you know, in September and October when the racing season's over, the best thing to do is really rest, to recharge for the following year. But I love my mountain bike, so I was on my mountain bike throughout my whole career. Every off season in the fall, I would ride it like 4 or 5 days a week. And so, you know, I guess I honed my skills a little bit throughout the years and was able to hang with my faster friends. As far as Leadville goes, I mean, that's not so technical. It's pretty much a road race on a mountain bike.
Okay.
And it comes down to fitness more than any technical skills.
For those of you guys, the Leadville, theoretically, it's one of the toughest mountain bike races on the planet. It's at between 11 and 13,000 feet, is that right? I mean, it's 30% less oxygen at Leadville in Colorado. I mean, it's really a brutal race. And you guys were doing it in, what, about 6 hours?
The altitude is brutal. It's excruciating, actually, especially when you're up at the high point, which is, I think, about 12.8 on top of Columbine. And you're dizzy, you're seeing stars, you're nauseous, but you keep going, and everybody does. So,
well, it really starts to beg the next question, because, you know, I see that if you guys are basically the Formula One of athletes, where you're literally sometimes, we've seen the pictures of our best American cyclists and best international cyclists on the verge of, it looks like, I mean, you're at margins of health, you know, and you really have had a successful career of coming out unharmed. You're still riding, you're still not haunted by tons and tons of dysfunction. What do you think, sort of different from you than other people, even just surviving the gazillions of crashes you have, like what do you think is the difference that you rode and then were literally ride into your late 30s? I think you were 37 or 38 when you won the Tour de Suisse. Like what's the difference? What is there a magic formula for you that made that possible, that resiliency? Because it's really remarkable and something we need to talk about.
Well, I don't know. I guess I was just mainly blessed with good genes.
True fact.
I was able to get away with some stuff, you know. I remained relatively injury-free. I mean, I broke a couple bones in crashes, but other than that, I didn't have any chronic reoccurring injuries throughout my career, so I was very fortunate in that sense. You know, I did do some cross-training. I did some Pilates. Obviously, you helped me out a lot in like later years when we met, and help fix my right hip there. So, you know, those little things, just staying on top of it like that. Good diet, I think, is good diet, rest a lot.
The good diet is a piece. I think, you know, it's interesting right now, I think, in the world of performance athletics, for sure, we've taken a page out of the endurance chat book, and we've seen a real switch back to whole foods, where, you know, people are, you know, eating less shakes, they're drinking. Stacey Sims is like, hey, stop drinking your calories, start eating whole foods again. We've definitely seen a switch back. I know that you guys and your family eat a certain way. Can you talk about sort of the basis of your sports nutrition, even generally as a family now, and even as sort of as you were, you know, at the highest levels fueling performance? What were some of those tenets that made you successful? What did you do?
Well, you know, as cyclists, like, we burn so many calories. We, at certain times, especially in, like, the Tour de France, we had to eat so much. Like, it was crazy. And we were lucky enough that we had our own chef at the biggest races. We had our own chef that would prepare the food. And so we ate like kings. But, you know, it also meant we ate a lot. I mean, we would have dessert as well. You know, we were eating healthy, like vegetables and, you know, rice and good lean meats and good fats. And I think basically just having a balanced diet, never doing something that was so extreme, like no carbs or no protein, or you know what I mean, like no fat. Like, it's a good balance. And of course, you know, you have to like sort of indulge yourself as well. Otherwise, it's just too boring and you crack, you know. So I think the key word is balance.
Balance. I will say that Levi's wife makes one of the greatest cookies I've ever had. I mean, that's, I don't know if that needs to be public, a matter of public record, but it's like, yeah, it's in the all-time three cookies, and it's hot, and I had those chihuahuas in my face, and maybe it was all context, but that cookie is all-time, and I think it really does speak, yeah, to sort of this balanced approach. You know, it's amazing that you finished, I don't know how many Olympic aerobic level, highest level sport, but they seem to put on 20 pounds when they, I mean, like Michael Phelps is a good example, I think, of a kid who stopped racing and immediately blimped up. You have remained really lean. In fact, you sent me a picture of your calf recently about something, and it was just shredded and jacked, and I mean, it looked like as big as my quad. What have you had, yeah, to feel like you've throttled back on, or had to pay attention that you couldn't eat like a maniac anymore? Has there been any transitional problems like that?
Well, I think that's part of the reason I keep riding my bike so much, because I'm like, if I stop riding, I can't eat as much, so I better keep riding.
Yeah, I like it. I resemble that. Yeah. Totally. When, yeah, I noticed, you know, you guys, I think it's interesting. We're seeing in sort of the professional athletics that haven't been traditionally endurance based, we're seeing now a really resurgence in time spent on aerobic training. And really putting money into that aerobic bank. And we're also finding that our athletes who did not have an aerobic sport as a child, were not playing soccer or football or swimming or running, sometimes are at a disadvantage. They're like, they're missing 10 years of hard aerobic conditioning that really starts to show up in some of these sports. Even in our power athletic sports, we're seeing that you've got to be kind of paying homage to that aerobic piece. When did you start really paying attention? When did you know that, like, you sort of had this aerobic gift?
Pretty early on. I mean, I remember, so my brother, he's 7 years older than I am. I'm watching Jupiter play behind you. It's pretty funny. But anyway, my brother, he's 7 years older than I am. He and his friends were riding on road bikes. And so I was like 12 at the time, and I remember watching him do a race. And I jumped on his bike, and I was like blown away how efficient and fast road bikes were. So the next year, when I was 13, I got my own road bike, and I started riding with them. And I'm in tennis shoes and a T-shirt and sunglasses, and you know, like the first 2 weeks were kind of rough. I didn't know what I was doing, and I got dropped. But then already after 2 weeks, we were going up some big climb where I grew up in Montana, and I dropped them all. And it was like, all of a sudden, it just clicked. So, you know, right from when I was 13, like, I don't know, it's some indescribable feeling that I had that's what I was meant to do. And, you know, I loved it, I was good at it, and it just all came together for me.
You know, we're seeing that there are these stories amongst our best aerobic athletes that, and power athletes, even, that they had a seminal moment where they realized that they were good at something, but also just looking at training age. One of the, I think, the pieces that people don't know about you, and all sometimes this gets lost in the headlines of the outlier level performance, is that you are a phenomenal athlete. And, like, you grew up doing other sports, too. You weren't just a bike racer. Can you talk about your sort of athletic background?
Well, yeah, I mean, I was on skis when I was like one, because my parents are both ski instructors, and they have a ski shop there in Montana, which my brother now operates. So we were a big skiing family. Every weekend up skiing, and you know, I was a ski racer since I was like, I don't know, 3-4 years old, and I did that until I was 19, pretty seriously. And that's how I found cycling, is like, you know, it complemented skiing, so that's why I got into cycling. Like, I need to get in shape. When I was about, you know, 13, 14 years old, I was like, I need to do something in the summer so I'm stronger in the winter. But then little did I know that, you know, that was going to be my thing, that it took over. But, yeah, I was from a very young age, I was competitive and I was athletic, and you know, I obviously tried all sports, like the ball and stick sports, but they weren't my thing. I didn't have the right body type or talent for that. So luckily I found what I was good at.
Yeah, seriously for us all. It's interesting because, you know, and just the people who are listening, Levi has a legit squat. Like, you move really well. And what's fun is to see, you know, clearly, you know, strength to weight ratio has come back into vogue. It's never been out of vogue in terms of our athletic endeavors, but we're seeing that there is a cost at being a bigger athlete and running. And we were looking at, and just even you and I were talking the other day, just about how, hey, you know, hey, squatting is a way of getting your hips and keeping your hips working right, even if we're not using it to build absolute strength, especially when we're watching, you know, strength to weight issues. But your mechanics are really, like, your indigenous mechanics are beautiful. And I think the reason I wanted to point that out to people is I think it's easy to see, point a finger sometimes at our endurance athletics and say, hey, these guys can't do this. And that really was not the case with you, that you really moved well, and that it's, for me, it's not an accident that you've had such an amazing, pretty much injury-free career, even in spite of the crashes, but also because you grew up doing multiple sports and racing. And we're seeing a pattern with a lot of the conversations that we're having where the sliding sports, surfing, skating, you know, kayaking, skiing, snowboarding, are really crucial to developing sort of brain patterning about taking input and planning, feeding forward, and that's a crucial aspect, as is developing, making sure your kids are in some kind of aerobic sport and a ball sport. So, you know, because one of the greater conversations we're having now is what makes athletes ready and how do we continue to do that? And you didn't just specialize at age 13. You were saying, hey, this is my off-season sport. I love this. And we have seen, you know, even talking like Chris Davenport about his ski racing, he said, you know, he lives on the bike now. Jeremy Jones lives on the bike. Travis Rice, you know, these guys spend a lot of time on the aerobic stuff, but they also came from that same background that you did, but just kind of specialized in the thing. So it's I think I want to just make that clear because you really move well, and I think it's something that it's easy to forget how much time you spent becoming a good athlete and then being able to leverage that on the bike.
Yeah, well, ski racing is known for its like dry land training and a lot of weightlifting. We, you know, I did a lot of squats as a teenager and a lot of running drills out on the field. So, yeah, I think that was a good base at a young age to be able to handle the two-dimensional sport of cycling, because cycling, you're in a fixed plane. It's a repetitive motion you do millions of times over. You know, there's no side to side. You can easily become weak and, I mean, yeah, because we're burning so many calories and we're burning off all the excess muscle we don't use. And that means stabilizers, hip stabilizers, for example, you know, the piriformis and pectineus and all those little muscles around your hips that you don't really use in cycling, and your body has to be extremely efficient. So those are just fuel and they get burned off because they're excess weight. They're not doing anything. And you don't want to haul them up and down the Alps and the Pyrenees and the Tour de France because they're just dead weight.
Hell no. Now, when you have the first time I saw a pair of Normatec boots, you guys, I feel like some of your team and teammates and like Alan Lim, really ahead of the curve. And you know, people are familiar with the mouth guards that we use and we like. You know, I came to know that through Greg Uckert, the physician, the dentist who's working with you guys. You guys were really on, had set the standard for what it looked like. Was it Bradley, who is the head of British Cycling, who calls it the aggregation of marginal gains, his concept of little bits and here and there? But, you know, your recovery piece was pretty sophisticated. I remember Odessa saying she loved the Normatec compression boots because it made her legs look great before she went out, right? But and she's a legit athlete herself, an amazing cyclist. But you know, do you were there parts of your recovery adaptation routine that you feel like were vital? And can you talk about some of those things, especially as we take the sort of the Formula One concept and spin it backwards to the moms and dads out there, the recreational athletes like us?
Well, that whole recovery routine and protocol, it really evolved throughout my cycling career. You know, when I first got into the sport, those marginal gains weren't looked at. The sport was in a different place, and it was not looking at those little things. You didn't have to. Now, as the sport evolved, you know, in my last year in the Tour de France, 2012, we would finish a stage and, you know, back up 2002, we'd finish a stage. I mean, a full-on sprint, like everything you've got, right? Anaerobic, creating all kinds of toxins in your body. You sprint to the finish line. What do? You stop immediately. You get in the bus. You take a shower. That's not so great, actually. So fast forward 10 years. Well, what do? We go to the bus. All the trainers are set up, the stationary trainers. We put our bikes on them. We spin for about 10, 12 minutes, cool down, a proper cool down, which, you know, that's like one of the first rules of sport. You got to cool down, right? I mean, it helps prevent injuries and you flush out all those toxins. So we would do that. Then we would go, we had this box van that had a little kiddie pool in it with a recirculator, and it kept the water at about, let's say, 38 degrees. So we would get in there for 10 minutes. So big ice bath, cool down, tell the body to shut down. Then we would get on the bus, shower, have our recovery drinks and a little bit of food, and then we would hook up to the muscle stim, the Mark Pro, and as we transferred to our hotel, we would be using that and a massage stick to help, you know, sort of loosen up the muscles. Of course, when you get to the hotel, it's more food, it's massage, it's dinner, more food again, and get to sleep as soon as possible and get up and repeat the next day.
Was there
so it became a lot more time consuming, you know, over the years.
It was definitely easier just to drink a Coke and go sit on the bus.
Yeah.
Was there a magic number of amount of sleep? What, like, you know, because we're starting now to have technologies like Omega Wave, where we can really track this parasympathetic, sympathetic kind of state people are in. But, you know, prior to that, I think every good coach knew when you were burned or not burned, theoretically. They could just tell your wattage isn't good, your heart rate's not there. I mean, these correlates, I mean, wattage is not a correlate, but heart rate's definitely a correlate. You know, was there a magic sleep amount that you had in training, and are you still seeing that today?
I always needed, like, a good 9 hours, I felt like, is what I needed. I think I get less now, but in the Tour, you know, in the big races, it was really tricky because you were so amped up and you were so wired and ready and stressed that sleep became a real issue. You know, times when you didn't sleep so well and you really felt it the next day. You were in a hole, and it took a couple nights to get out of that hole. So sleep is important. And you know, some guys, they're blessed with the ability to, you know, put their head on the pillow and they're out. That wasn't like me. I had a hard time turning off.
Are you a caffeine or no caffeine guy?
My whole career, I was no caffeine, and now I have an espresso machine.
I love it. That's fantastic. No caffeine.
Yeah.
Is that because did you use it on race day, or did you just felt like, you know, it didn't work with your system well?
I only had it for time trials. Yeah. I didn't want to be dependent on it was probably the main reason.
Yeah.
Because I felt like a lot of people, you know, they were like, oh my God, I need my coffee, I can't do anything, and I just wanted to focus on my natural energy, and then I would have some coffee or whatever before a time trial.
When I talk to you, you are one of the most sophisticated athletes who sort of has a real understanding of how their body works. Have you always been like that? And do you think that, I think it's important, but you really have a sort of a deep sophistication of understanding sort of your soft tissue needs and your anatomy. Do you feel like, I mean, how did you come to that?
Well, I was a professional for a long time. I'm 17, 18 years, a lot of massages, a lot of massage therapists who had a good understanding of the body. They knew the muscle groups, and I would just pepper them with questions. What's that? That's tight. What's that muscle? And so then it was good because eventually I could be like, hey, my sartorius is tight on my right side. Can you focus on that, please? And they would know exactly what to do. So for me, it was just being able to accomplish my recovery needs as best as possible. I don't know. It just came naturally.
You're in this interesting phase now where you're not doing as much of volume, and you're a little bit older. I think we're the same age now. I think that's like you just turned 26, and what have you noticed about the engine or the body kind of coming into it as serious as a master's athlete now? You're just on this side of 40. What are I have seen massive changes in the way I have to approach training and can you talk about some of those specifics for the master's athletes, what you see? Because you have a bunch of riding buddies still who make some basic errors sometimes. What are the errors that you see are like in the age group athletes like us who are former jocks? I'm not going to compare myself to you, but a former jock now, we see a lot of people get into trouble because they're still trying to be like they were 20s, but what are the differences you're seeing now in your own body as you go in terms of being aerobic output or training level, and what are some of the mistakes you're seeing around some of these other guys?
The thing that comes to my mind is consistency. Like, if I'm consistent in my workouts and I'm not always pushing myself, I'm training at a level where I'm obviously, stimulating myself to make myself tired, but I'm not completely emptying myself, because I don't recover so well from that anymore. I used to be able to do something, something huge, and then, I could make it through the next day again if I wanted to. But now it's like it takes it out of me. And I see with other people, they've got a lot going on. They've got work, they've got kids, their life is busy, so they'll miss a bunch of days of training, and then on the weekend or whatever, they'll go out and they'll just smash themselves. And then so it's kind of, they put themselves in a hole, and then they have to do nothing to recover, and then, they're not really ever making gains. They're just going from overworking to recovery. And so you have to be a little bit methodical about it, hold back, and build slowly. That's my view of my friends. And
I think that's so true. What about warming up? So let's say I'm about to go out. I'm training for this 50K race. What I notice is that I literally have to put in the warm-up time. Can you talk about what your warm-up looks like? Does it still look like you're just riding easy for a while and your heart rate comes up naturally? Or do you have like a prep system or you've always done? How do you do that?
Yeah, I actually help train a couple of master's athletes in the area, and my training over the years was always sort of the same. Like, if it was a 4 or 5 hour ride, I'd start off, and the first at least 20 minutes was easy, probably 20 to 30 minutes, just easy riding, and then the first set of intervals were just a medium intensity, like usually on the flats, so that you're not climbing, you're not really. It's not that stressful. It's on the flats where you have some momentum. You can kind of stop pedaling here and there if you need to. But like I said, it's a medium intensity where it's comfortable. You could talk. If there's someone next to you, you could talk. But it's another step in the warm-up process to get to where you really need to put the work in, the intense intervals, like climbing at threshold or even over threshold. So it would probably last a good hour before I would get into anything intense. But that's cycling. Cycling's different. You can, it's very low impact. You're on the most efficient machine ever invented by man. So you have that time. You can go out and do 5 hours. Now, if you're talking about running or whatever it is, I think that gets compressed. The time gets compressed so that you can do like 15 minutes of warm up, and then, like I said, something in the medium zone before you really start to push yourself. And it's obviously like it's up and then it's back down to easy and then it's back into medium and then easy, and you're kind of all over the place.
I mean, if you're listening to this, that is the most sage advice ever of all time. We're seeing that athletes, especially when the call is for intensity, that the workup needs to be a lot slower and a lot more sort of prep than we think. We see athletes who roll into the gym early and just kind of hit it, and it's like a fire hose against a hard wall. There's no permeability there. You've got to give yourself a chance to warm up. I think that, I mean, this call for many reasons is so valuable to people, but that piece of advice is massive. I have a 5K time trial today, and I'm like, how long do I need to get going and have touched those interval peaks before I blow up, because I'm already dreading this 5K time trial, you know?
We, in cycling, we call it opening up. You got to open up, like for time trials especially, we would have a very specific warm-up protocol. And something else that came to my mind is, you know, if you've had rest days or easy days before, it takes even longer to do that warm-up process. If you've been in a workout routine, like if you had a hard day the day before, it actually takes less time to warm up the next day. But if you've, like I said, if you haven't done anything in 2 days, well, then you really need to be careful, because the more time you take off, all those muscles tighten up. And sometimes, you know, in cycling, you can't do it in 1 day. It takes 2 days. Like, for example, Tour of California would roll around. You know, I would take my easy day 2 days before the race. But the day before, I actually did a pretty hard workout, because the prologue was always to start the race off, and it was very important to do well in that prologue. You didn't want to give up any seconds. So the day before, I was out doing intervals. I was motor pacing on my time trial bike. And actually, like, intense intervals at threshold or even a little bit above, so that the next day before the time trial, I'd do a normal warm-up routine, and I was open. We would call it open in cycling, ready to go.
We see a lot of people when they taper or take those days off, they think they're resting. They're resting for a big interval piece, or like you say, you know, we see that a lot of people sort of even lose their touch. I worked with a number of good athletes, even one of our best sort of All-American swimmers. Her coach would say, hey, look, I don't want you in the pool the day before. And she'd be like, but I lose my touch. And I was like, hey, look, your coach doesn't want you to work out hard. But, you know, having a touch or getting a sweat or you know, keeping the engine idling and revved a few times, you know, obviously your fitness is not that's not going to destroy your fitness. You know, I think yeah. People who are underprepared maybe. But that's a huge
yeah. That's what I was saying about people who they do nothing like all week or something, and they destroy themselves on the weekend. Well, they've gotten tight all week. They're sedentary. They're either sitting down at the desk. Everything's gotten really tight, and then they want to go out and smash it on the weekend, but their body's not ready. So if they could just keep the engine running, even if it's light, easy, short workouts throughout the week, come the weekend, they're going to be so much better off because they didn't get tight and their body's ready to go. And so, yeah, if you've got an important event, like on, let's say, Sunday, you know, you definitely want to do something on Saturday. That's not your day to rest, in my opinion. You know, you want to, I wouldn't say long. You don't want to empty yourself and fatigue yourself, but you need to touch on those zones of intensity to make sure those muscles are loose for the next day.
Right on. That is just, that's the best. Do you still track morning heart rate? Did you ever look at that when you were racing? Is that part of your?
I did that. I think I did that as an amateur, but nah, not so much. You know, heart rate got kind of thrown out the door in cycling when power came along.
Boy, isn't that the truth? Are you still on the crank? Do you crank? Are you on the? I hear there's pedal watt meters now. I mean, are you on your hubs? Are you a Garmin guy? Like you know, what are you riding these days?
Oh yeah. Yeah, I have it's called a Quark, which is a power meter, but it's at the spindle. It's in the crank. So I still have power on my bikes. I got to know how much I'm losing over the years.
So give us
not much.
Just as a baseline, because I'll use this. One of our good friends, her name's Erin Cafaro. She's a couple of Olympic gold medalists in rowing, and you know, her engine is ridiculous, just ridiculous still in terms of, I mean, I swear she doesn't have a leg, she has an extra lung going down her leg. I mean, still like that. When you're, I know you're just retired and hanging out with your friends and, you know, casually cycling, but, you know, you're putting out these watts, you know, what sort of, give us a taste of what it looks like still to have Levi's legs. Like, what can you push for, like, you know, 20, 30 minutes?
Well, last week I did this climb on a whim. It's near town, and I felt really good, and so I blasted up it. It was actually a 12-minute effort. I did 411 average, but I weigh 62 kilos, so in cycling that's about, I don't know, 6.8 kilo, watts per kilo, which I was pretty stoked because that's the kind of power that, you know, I had during my career. And for me to still be able to do that is like, kind of makes me happy, you know.
As a reference, I once want to jump on the watt bike, and I try to hold between 400 and 500 watts for like 30 seconds for repeats. The idea of holding that for 12 minutes makes me sort of nauseous on the inside. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, hey, last question. You work with a bunch of young kids. You know, obviously, the amount of cycling data about how to train and get kids prepped for these races is amazing. I mean, we're seeing such sophistication at even the high school level now. I mean, the access. You know, what would be some of your young counsel to some of our young mountain biker kids in the Bay Area? Because there's all these amazing teams. Are kids specializing too soon? Like, what sort of, if you could go back and talk to these young kids and what you're doing now, are there pieces of advice that they absolutely have to hear?
I think what you said there about specializing too soon is key. I think a lot of times I find myself trying to hold them back. You know, they're really gung-ho and serious, and they want to be on a specific training program and doing intervals every day. And I'm like, especially for cycling, because cycling is a sport that you don't peak until you're like, now I think it's, you're in your 30s. You know, it used to be that they thought it was later 20s, but I think it's actually in the earlier 30s, even mid-30s now. So I'm like, you know, you guys are young. You just have fun. Don't do intervals because you're going to burn yourselves out. I mean, if you really want to, you know, make cycling your life, then you're in it for a long time, decades to come. So just hold on, you know, have fun and don't worry about specific intervals. I mean, they're still growing kids, and you know, they've got other interests, and I think it's too young.
I love it. I love the example of like Tyler Finney, you know, just being, you know, held back by his parents for so long before they let him go, you know, be a crazy young kid, you know. Where would we find out about the Gran Fondo and the work that you're doing? Where could we be part of that? Where would people find out about that?
Well, thanks for asking. It's levisgranfondo.com. Do a search for Levi's Gran Fondo.
And when is
October.
It? October.
October 3rd, yeah. Yeah.
There are some legit cyclists who show up, too. I mean, this is like a – it's pretty amazing event. I love it.
Yeah, you're going to come do like at least the 30-miler, right?
We are there. You can count on it for sure. We'll be in it this year.
Yeah.
I think you have the fat – you have the fat guy division, and I'm going to be the fattest, oldest guy. So I'll be
no,
there.
No. Not even close, dude. Not even close. You have no idea. You have no excuses.
That's true. And since we found out I'm an aerobic responder, I'm there. I mean, this is all I do now. I'm
just right?
That's right.
Exactly.
That's right.
Exactly.
Hey, Levi, are you on social media at all? Do you Instagram? Do you Twitter? Do you any of that stuff?
Yeah, I do it all. I do the, you know, three, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook.
Where would we find you? Where would we find out about your training and what you're doing and all the fun stuff you guys are up to?
My name on all of those is Levi Leipheimer.
At Levi Leipheimer?
No.
That's great.
Yeah.
And then for those of us who are obsessed with little rescue dogs, you guys work with a rescue organization in Northern California. What's that rescue organization called?
Well, Odessa is on the board of the Humane Society here, and the Forget-Me-Not Farm that I spoke of earlier is actually on the property of the Sonoma County Humane Society there. So, that's our organization.
And my wife wants to know, who made that door behind you? She loves that thing. We're going to get all these texts about this awesome door in your house. Your house
door? It's my friend Dan Boyle. He's a local cyclist, a realtor, contractor. He helped do our kitchen, and so he himself made that door. It's pretty cool. It's
pantry. That is badass. The pantry.
Yeah.
Behind there is all the cakes and all the things that you allegedly don't eat, right? We know. Well, hey, Levi, thank you so much, man. This has been, you know, I am just a neophyte endurance kid, but you know, I love this. We've gotten so many pieces out of this, and really, thank you so much for your time. You're such a tremendous athlete and such a great ambassador for the sport. And if you're in Northern California, you find yourself in October, come to Levi's Gran Fondo. And, you know, maybe you can, if you see that little young kid out on the trail, go ahead and try to jump on his wheel for a second. Good luck with that.
Yeah. Thanks. Thanks, everybody. Good
Thanks,
talking
Levi.
To you, Kelly. Thanks.